Welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show from Austin, Texas. I'm the Internet's Christopher Schmidt, and on today's show, we're discussing self-autonomous vehicles, or sometimes commonly called self-driving cars. Joining me as co-host is Simon St. Laurent, the content manager at lynda.com. On this episode, our guests are Dr. Sean Brannon, professor from the Department of Mechanical and Nuclear Engineering at Penn State. Also, Paul Schmidt, the Director of Automated Vehicles at Mass Robotics and invited expert at the White House on autonomous vehicles. This show is one Simon and I have been planning on doing for a while. We really wanted to reach out to find experts to find out what is really happening in the space of self-driving cars and also try to figure out what the impact a self-driving car in our society will have to our digital lives. So I hope you'll find this conversation as interesting as we did. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. The UX Design Newsletter is a weekly list of articles, tutorials, and inspiration handpicked by me. Sign up at uxdesignnewsletter.com and have the best links of the week sent to your email. Set it and forget it with a Non-Breaking Space Show newsletter. So whenever a new show is ready, you'll be notified right in your inbox. All you have to do is sign up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. Did you know that we have a YouTube channel? So you can watch our episodes raw and unedited at youtube.com/nonbreakingspaceshow. If you hear about a site or resource listed in today's episode, chances are you'll find it as a link in the episode's show notes, which you can find at nonbreakingspace.tv. Be sure to follow me, Christopher, on Twitter at Teleject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. As always, thank you for telling others about Non-Breaking Space, and be sure to follow us and subscribe us in iTunes to catch the next episode. Now, on with the show. We're welcoming a great guest today for Non-Breaking Space Show. Our first guest is Dr. Sean Brannon. He's a professor from the Department of Mechanical and Nuclear Engineering from the Pennsylvania State University. Also, he's affiliated faculty to Thomas D. Larson Transportation Institute and director of the Intelligent Vehicles and Systems Research Group. So welcome to the show, Dr. Brannon.
Hey there. Hi, everybody. Glad to talk to you today.
And it's okay if we call you Sean.
Of course.
Okay. And joining us as well is Paul Schmidt. He's the director of automated vehicles at Mass Robotics, and he's invited expert to the White House on autonomous vehicles. I guess we should also make that was the previous administration, and we're still waiting for the invite to the newest administration. By the mailbox.
Either way, I was humbled to be asked. Yeah. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we're happy that you're here. And then joining me is my sometimes co-host is Simon St. Laurent. Hi, Simon.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Cool. Awesome. And Simon, you are content?
I'm a content manager at LinkedIn Learning. I mostly focus on web topics, but I like to get into all kinds of tech, so should be fun.
Yeah, so awesome. Yeah, this is a show that Simon and I have been wanting to do for a long time. And the nature is talking about autonomous vehicles, because there's just a lot of talk about autonomous vehicles in the press, and sometimes the press get things wrong, or they're not really up to date on the technology out there. So, Sean, if you could just give us a state of autonomous vehicles right now, that'd be great. Because, my audience, like I said, like they're kind of web engineers, and we hear companies like Apple and Google, which we know, from being web developers, we know them pretty well, but now they're developing autonomous vehicle technologies. And then we also know Uber, because we use Uber a lot because we can't park downtown in Austin. Yeah, in Austin, not all anymore. And then there's Tesla, which has the self-driving car feature, which now is autopilot, now enhanced autopilot feature. So, I just want to see if, Sean, if you could just give us the lowdown on what the state of autonomous vehicles is.
Sure. For those that don't know, we've been working on autonomous vehicles in the automotive industry for probably about 100 years now. And I say that from the context of most of us actually don't control many parts of the vehicle that we think we do. A good example of that is the throttle. When you hit the throttle body, many people probably envision a big old linkage that goes from your pedal into the engine, and that disappeared long ago. computers today have been controlling the throttle body for decades. And one consequence of that is significantly improved fuel economy and the ability to do some neat stuff like cruise control and engine management, engine diagnostics, all sorts of things. And that's just one aspect. But where we're at today really is an evolution in the technology over time. In the industry, we've defined this evolution in stages, stages 1 through 5. And we really got to about stage 3 in the probably, I'd say, middle 80s, maybe early 90s, to where vehicles were doing many of the subsystem functionalities without our intervention. And I'm saying things like the automatic transmission in your car and the throttle body whenever you're doing cruise control. And we thought we would evolve into a technology that would work alongside humans, and you'd basically click a button on the highway, it would drive you for a little bit, and then it would hand it off to you when things got dicey, and you'd take over. And the reality was that that turned out to be a lot harder than we thought. And so starting about 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, really motivated by defense funding through DARPA challenges, DARPA Grand Challenge, DARPA Urban Challenges, there was a big push to just skip over that level of autonomy to where fully autonomous vehicles started becoming the main focus. And that really ironed out many of the core challenges of the field, particularly understanding the needs for information management, advanced sensors, the use of map registration and simultaneous mapping while we're driving and navigating the world. How to track objects as they're moving around. And so these are all technologies that have converged and merged. The costs have come way down, and to where my understanding talking with industry colleagues is that many of our modern vehicles are essentially software updates away from being largely autonomous in the context of hitting a button, being able to drive. The challenges today, there still remain some pretty hard technological challenges. I think we'll get into that in the discussion. And there's some interesting ethics and legal challenges as well.
I love the intro, Sean. Great job. You start off with a very broad question. So there's literally 1,000 different ways that we could go with that. But I think Sean did a great job of bringing us to, I think, where we are today. I think the big picture to me of where we are today is it's very exciting. There's a number of companies that are actively working on this technology. And I think maybe we want to initially just lay some groundwork to prevent confusion, because it's very easy to get confused. Okay. The Tesla system, for example, the autopilot system, I would classify that like as a SAE level 3 system. Okay. Sean, maybe we could debate that, but... What that is, where the vehicle does take longitudinal lateral control of the vehicle, but the driver needs to be aware of this, the situation, what's happening in the vehicle. Mm-hmm. Whereas a level 4 and level 5 systems, and depending upon the type of level 4, the driver can be really out of the picture totally. And I think what Sean was saying earlier with the DARPA funding and with enabling, pushing the research and development to level 4 and level 5 is really exciting and very powerful. And I think that, as Sean was saying, that took away a lot of the technical challenges. For me, one of the biggest ones is that for level 3, there's actually two drivers in the vehicle, if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
There's one of them is human. And so there has to be some type of really good communication between those two drivers. Mm-hmm. And if one of those drivers happens to think that the other driver is a level 5, you can get into some problems. So those communication of the human driver knowing what the non-human, the AI driver is doing, is not doing, and the user interface challenges there. Mm-hmm. There's very significant technology challenges there. Mm. And I think, so jumping that to level 4 and level 5 is the way that a number of companies are going. Mm. And I'll just summarize, I think from an exciting picture of where we are today, from what I've seen, we're seeing some companies that are just starting to announce that they have a level 4 type technology. When I say level 4, it's limited in some way, like geofenced, to a certain region, maybe certain weather conditions. But it can take maybe full driving task. Mm. We're seeing some companies that are announcing that they will have offering rides with these type of vehicles in certain cities within 6 months or so.
Yeah.
We'll see. but that's very exciting. I think Utonomy is one that said that in Singapore they'll start offering rides.
Yeah.
On the short term, but again, we'll see. And that, so I think once that happens, I think they, here in the United States, they're operating in Boston. So I would expect them to start offering rides in Boston not too far after that. Okay. And I think the big news from Uber last week, and they've got 24,000 vehicles, Volvo vehicles that they want to employ. Yeah. That's a lot of capital that'll be sitting around if they don't put that to work very quickly. So I would expect to hear some news from them shortly. Okay, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. So level 5 then would just be like people just get in the car and you don't, doesn't matter where you go.
Sure. I'll take a short stab at that, and Sean, jump in. I can see you're eager to jump in. I think level 5, I honestly don't think that we will see for several years. The folks in the industry that I talk to say, a level 5 would be like a vehicle where you go to the dealership and you buy it, and it doesn't even have a steering wheel in it. It doesn't have pedals in it. It just, you tell it, there's an app, or you tell it where to go, and it takes you there.
Yeah.
We're at least several years away from seeing that. So that's why I think level 4, that's where you'd see, and that's, there's significant technology problems associated with level 5. Working in all kinds of weathers and all kinds of road conditions, there's a lot of challenges there.
Yeah.
So that's why you see companies breaking down that large problem into tackleable problems. I'll limit it to this geographic area. I'll limit it to this type of weather condition.
Yeah. Okay. So, Sean, is that?
Yeah, ditto on that. I think the way I describe level 5 to my students when I'm training them to try to implement some of these technologies is level 5 is the chauffeur. You hop in the car and it takes you there. You don't need a driver's license. You don't even need to be in the car. You could put your kids in there and it should be able to take them to wherever. And as Paul mentioned, there's some really hard challenges with that, not just with reliability and weather, but also, we're going to slowly start stepping into some of the ethical questions rather quickly, I think, in this discussion is, say you have your wife is pregnant or you happen to be pregnant and you need to get to the hospital and it's a snowstorm. And I've had the joy of having two children, both in the middle of snowstorms. And having a car that would refuse operation for very legitimate and ethical reasons, and then also to have a situation where the driver might be not licensed or trained enough to operate the vehicle, and yet you get into emergency situations. And so it starts to become a question that as vehicle engineers, we really start having to tackle questions about ethics and societal choices and how to assist people, how to make really large life and death type of decisions, even though really what we've been trained to do is move a vehicle around safely. And that becomes really hard. The domain space that we're working in is really growing faster than our capability to learn it. And so we find that I think in all of our fields, I think Paul would agree that our arms are getting larger and larger in all of the different disciplines we have to hug together and make work. And so a lot of the core challenges, go well beyond vehicle engineering and go deeply into ethics and psychology, human factors, civil engineering, even the ability to manage and control traffic congestion with autonomous vehicles. That's a very difficult and open question right now.
Well, like with level 5, like you talk about it being the chauffeur, but even with level 4, though, if, with Tesla's autopilot feature, if that was, mainstream and popular enough, like how do you see this affecting, normal traffic patterns and stuff like that?
So You know, level four on the level of the Tesla vehicle, you know, I'd say not only highway driving to where high-speed driving, very well confined environments, very short, short but infrequent major decision points, whether or not you need to make an on-ramp or an off-ramp, not long-term durations of tough decisions, for example, navigating, you know, complex pedestrian traffic. I think that's on its way, and already with traffic patterns, there's the potential that we have to start thinking about it. One of the places that we know that we want to go rather soon is the ability to start platooning vehicles on the highway to increase vehicle throughput. It has huge implications.
What do you mean by platooning?
Oh, okay. So platooning is the ability to have a lead vehicle coordinate. Usually, there's levels of platooning. Usually start to coordinate the throttle and brake inputs from a lead vehicle to the vehicles that follow. And so many of us would like to tailgate, especially if we're in a tractor trailer, would like to tailgate the vehicle ahead of us to just push the wind out of the way. I mean, we could get like a 40% or better even fuel economy improvement by not having to move the air out of the way. And so if we can try to get nose to tail on those vehicles, what we call a platoon, it offers some significant economic advantage. That 40% is could be the difference between an average performing and the best performing business models for all of the trucking companies out there. The challenge that
even just in a traffic jam, that's what I want, is to just be able to say, follow the car ahead of me. I don't, you know, we're doing 5 miles an hour. I don't want to have to pay attention to this.
Bingo. Yeah. And there's a name for some of this. It's an evolution of the cruise control technology. Cruise control, we set a speed and the vehicle goes. And then we now have evolved to automatic cruise control, ACC systems, which use essentially radar systems. Some have some variation on that, but basically radar systems to slow the cruise control setting down so that if we're in stop and go traffic, we can follow the leader. We're still responsible for, you know, core brake and throttle function, but we're not really taking advantage of the close space keeping to remove the aerodynamic load. Then there's the, what we're when we talk about platoons, we're starting to talk about what's called cooperative adaptive cruise control, CACC systems for short. And in that case, we're starting to talk about vehicles that are operating nose to tail, and the lead vehicle is communicating with the following vehicles, its brake and throttle inputs. And they're very carefully coordinating the leader-follower behavior so that the leader can't essentially lock the brakes on any of the following vehicles and have this disastrous, you know, multi-vehicle pileup. And so where the technology is going, where we talk about level four, is these type of merging behaviors where, you know, if we had these large platoons of, let's say, you know, 30 to 100 trucks going in a platoon down the highway, it very much looks like a train of vehicles. And many of the rules of the road that we currently live by might have to be modified. You can't essentially disassociate a platoon at the, you know, the intersection of, you know, 270 and the Beltway in DC and suddenly let all the trucks try to navigate that. I mean, it would be probably the perfect storm in creating, you know, a multi-vehicle traffic jam that would take most of the day to dissipate from then on. And so from the standpoint of policy, we then have to start thinking about the rules for platoons. They're going to be different than those for vehicles. We do have to have rules about when they're allowed to associate and disassociate. We'll probably have to have some type of change in the infrastructure. We'll have to have different types of lane geometries to allow us non-platooning drivers sometimes to get around the platoons. We'll have to train people how to accept those on the roads and develop acceptable behaviors on both ends. So it's going to be interesting. And when we're already starting to talk about traffic, I mean, the throughput on these platoons, some people estimate could be 3 times as many vehicles or more. But if that's going to come at the cost of having maybe 10 times as many traffic jams in the Beltway, that's something that we need to think about and plan for. And it's difficult to start analyzing these individual behaviors at a level of complexity of an entire infrastructure network, especially because the technologies themselves are evolving so quickly.
That's fascinating. Sean, that's it. And when you talked about traffic patterns, my mind jumped more to what the individual, the technology, the developers are facing right now. And Sean, I think you've got a much, you know, a great a bigger picture of you, but you know what my mind jumped to was some of the stories that I'm hearing from some of the developers in terms of, when you say, traffic patterns, like you know, now they're actually testing on real roads with real drivers and other vehicles. And you have to do that because they're learning things that you wouldn't learn on a development proving ground. But, a few examples are like, they said that, you know, their vehicle is approaching, let's say, a very busy traffic circle, or I think in New England they call it a rotary, something like that. And their vehicle is you know, it's tuned to be cautious. And as a result, you know, it sees a vehicle driving by the circle continuously. It never enters the circle, you know, for many minutes at a time.
That's like a plow drive. It's like, oh, I gotta wait.
And so, you know, in those type of situations, you know, as a human driver, you're trained to be, you know, somewhat aggressive, get your nose out there. And that's kind of, at this stage, that's the opposite direction that they want to go. Another great example is like a four-way stop, you know, a heavily, you know, congested four-way stop, you know, where there's, you know, if there's, you know, cars at the other three, you know, places in the intersection, and you know, and I know they never stop. You know, they'll come to a full, you know, and the vehicles are trained to follow the traffic education lesson book.
Yeah.
You know, where the vehicle must come to a full and complete stop, and so as a result, it just sits there for many minutes until. Yeah. So we're learning interesting things about traffic patterns at intersections. But
are you saying that people don't follow the rule book when they drive? I find that. I'm gassed.
Paul's hinting at something here that I think many of us take for granted, that being a good driver on the road is largely a question of learning psychology. You know, we cue off of the gaze point. We cue off of whether or not somebody's hand's near their head, you know, as they're driving, in terms of holding something next to their ear, or how many times they look in their rearview mirror. And as we get into these vehicles that do not provide these type of cues, it starts to become a question of how do we rely on an inference of awareness. If I'm going to cross in front of a vehicle at one of these infamous four-way stop signs, I'm certainly going to make eye contact with the human driver. Well, what do I do if the driver's asleep and the vehicle's driving? I mean, do I make eye contact with the radar? How do I confirm that I've been seen? And so the psychology of driving, I think, is really what differentiates, you know, that first, you know, year teen driver versus a more experienced and perhaps safer driver, just because we cue off of each other's emotions inadvertently and very subtly.
Hey, Sean, I've trademarked a name for this. Instead of inference of awareness, call it a glance dance. I mean, that's what it is, right? And that's, I mean, like, you're trying to merge, you know, you're trying to merge into a lane, and, you know, you get your nose in front of him, and then they gun it. You look at, you know, are they looking at me? Are they going to give me a time of day?
Yeah.
And same thing, like, if you're a pedestrian. I mean, think of, you know, I think this, you know, this, we should talk about how we integrate this technology into our everyday lives, and, you know, having these vehicles in situations where there's intersections and there's pedestrians crossing. You know, as a pedestrian, you know, there's a vehicle that's, you know, that's coming down the intersection. You look at their eyes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you want to make sure that they're aware of that of your presence, your existence, and that your intention to walk across the street. And yeah. There's this glance dance that occurs. And if there isn't any something on the other end to return that glance, you know, that's...
Yeah. Yeah, so basically, is there a glance happening back and forth? And then also, you know, also looking, you know, look to see the speed of the car, to see where the wheels are, if they're turning, if they're, like, you know, if they're hesitating a little bit, you know, and then that's where the aggressiveness comes in. If they're hesitating, they're like, oh, that's my shot. I have to go in because they're hesitating. They're allowing me to break in. So, yeah.
Well, something I've wanted for years, actually, before we got into the self-driving conversation, was better information on the outside of cars about intentions. I live in a place that has, you know, seven-way intersections, so somebody signaling left, what does that mean? I also live on a passing zone on a two-lane highway, and if I'm signaling left to turn into my driveway and people read that as he's about to pass someone, you can get into some really strange stuff. You know, maybe the glance dance becomes something where the intentions of the driver, whoever they, whether they're human or not, are actually, you know, imprinted on the outside of the car through lights or through some kind of, I don't know, cartoon face. That's what we need. No.
I think you put your finger on it. I think that area is really ripe for research. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions there, and I think there's a significant opportunity for some solutions.
Yeah, so I would second all of that and more. I think as technology is growing, we're discovering ways to share information between vehicles. Probably the one pushed forward the most aggressively is what's called dedicated short-range communication, or DSRC radios. And those are basically, one could think of them as really, really high-speed internet, with the trade-off that you can have very fast packet transfer on the order of milliseconds rather than tens or hundreds of milliseconds for what we would normally consider acceptable on the internet. But the trade-off is you have really small packet size. We're talking about here I am type of messages as you go around an intersection from one vehicle to another, or from a vehicle to a stoplight. And what's challenging with these types of messages is that, you know, not pun intended, but also somewhat unintended, they tend to be binary. They tend to be I'm here or I'm not here. And a vehicle has to assess whether or not to trust them. Whereas humans, we are really adept at gauging not only the signal, but the uncertainty in the signal. And that's something that's really hard to communicate. You know, I've many people have driven behind someone that just is constantly tapping the brake lights just lightly. And there's no information there. It's either on or off. And it can drive people crazy in the sense of trying to understand how aggressive is this brake being hit. And in the age of autonomy, I worry that we may have the same problem that we have with many technology-mediated communications. I'm thinking about the web and just about any other comment forum that you see at the bottom of a news article. When people lack the ability to provide subtlety, you know, when we have limited data channels, we tend to turn our gain way up. And there's a joke in autonomy called bang bang control. It's all on or all off. And I you see that in terms of the discourse and commentary on many a website, where people are either absolute hating at each other or absolutely in love. And I often wonder with autonomous vehicles if we're going to face that same challenge when autonomous vehicles or semi-autonomous vehicles or driver assist vehicles try to communicate information to the human. Now, the advantage of that is technology can mediate the human experience as well. We're starting to talk about things like augmented reality, heads-up displays in vehicles, allowing us to look through A-pillars or put display systems on A-pillars so that there's no longer such thing as a blind spot. You know, to be able to look through a vehicle ahead of you. One of the big challenges with these convoys we talked about is what do you stare at as you're going at, you know, whatever, 65 miles an hour down the highway and you're 3 feet away from the back of the tractor trailer. Maybe we can make that tractor trailer partially transparent. And so when that trailer is making a decision to change lanes or something, we can actually see what information is driving that decision. So the challenge, I think, with the technology aspect of it is how do we bootstrap both of those capabilities forward? One is the human perception and interaction and trust. And two is the sharing of information itself in a way that perhaps might not be binary. You know, how do we put uncertainty in information that is inherently binary?
I like that solution, Sean, making the truck semi-transparent. My vision was putting up movies on the back of the rig so that I could keep the driver behind in the tank. But no, I think that's a much better, nicer solution.
Yeah. But I guess so too, like, how do you test these devices, like test this, like platooning, like you need to test it before you put it out there in the real world, right? So basically, are you building like robot cities? Mm-hmm.
MCity is a good example of that. Colleagues at University of Michigan are focusing on low speed pedestrian arterial type environments. Highway testing is implicitly taking place by many of the OEMs that are out there testing their vehicle, primarily in highway situations. The U.S. government has designated 10 test track facilities around the country starting in January 1st, 2018. To be designated autonomous vehicle proving grounds. Implicitly, it also means connected vehicle proving grounds. But you're asking, you know, $1 trillion question, which comes down to not only how you test it, but how do you trust it? You know, what should be the corner cases Does a vehicle that claims to be autonomous on a highway have to work under a blinding snowstorm with iced up roads at 65 miles an hour with, you know, two flat tires and a broken windshield? Nobody would assume that that would be appropriate, but how far do you back away from that, you know, dark night scenario to get to a blue sky scenario? If we have autonomous systems that only work when the sun is shining and the roads are clear and there's no traffic and all the lane markers are well painted, et cetera, it becomes meaningless. And so finding those edge cases that all manufacturers agree on and all regulators agree on, that's a real challenge. It's not sufficient to just take an autonomous vehicle out and have it pass a driving test, because implicit in the driving test that we humans take is that we will learn. The driving test is just the minimum to get back out on the road and participate. And that's a very different type of driving test than one that is supposed to exercise the system's full functionality. And we haven't yet figured out how to do that. I think that's the fairest way to answer that is we honestly don't know how to do that right. We have ideas, and we can talk about that at length. We don't know.
Well, is it something like, I'm just going to throw this word out there, like it's just it solves all problems, but like artificial intelligence, like if I bought an autonomous vehicle and it would learn from me how I like to drive, would then it could learn my psychology of driving and then become my unique vehicle for driving?
Would you feel comfortable with that?
Yeah, because I totally trained it.
So would you be comfortable with somebody else's intelligence trained into it?
Exactly the same situation I'm in right now where I don't like that guy who's driving up there.
Would your insurance company be comfortable with that situation?
Exactly. And I have a challenge. I know that I have trouble looking behind a rearview mirror. All the accidents and near accidents I've been in have involved me in a situation where I don't tilt my head sideways to look around a mirror. And
that's
so certainly
I could, all folks have, Sean. The rearview mirror is right in our eye line.
I can train an algorithm to behave like myself. The thing is, what did I not train the algorithm to do? Or what did I train it to do incorrectly? And so we're getting into what's called verification. How do we know that training actually occurred? And what we would like the algorithm to do is to speak back to us in some way, some manner, to let us know what was learned. Can you instantiate the learning into something that we as humans can understand? And so the verifiability of the algorithm is of immense importance, so much so that, you know, many of the algorithms that people are promoting for learning on the road would never be allowed in aircraft. And honestly, my opinion, the aircraft problem is much, much easier than the road problem. Aircrafts don't have pedestrians that are going by them as they fly through the air. You know, they don't have clearance distances from oncoming aircraft that are measured in, you know, maybe 1/10 of the aircraft's width. That would be unheard of. We would be talking about Blue Angel type driving every time anybody was in the skies if we wanted to compare it to what we routinely do as highway drivers or normal driving. And so, you know, verifying what we learned and what artificial intelligence means is a really difficult problem. And I think that's gets really deep at the core of what these algorithms are supposed to help with, but at the same time, they could hurt us as well.
John, I'd summarize it in saying that, you know, we're struggling with defining how safe is safe. Mm-hmm. What are those metrics? I mean, the metrics that most folks are throwing around is humans are responsible for 90%+ of all accidents, and you know, we can talk about that number and how it was derived and so forth. But so that's the number that's kicked around. And so, you know, I think a general rule of thumb that I think that most folks would be happy with is, well, as long as the vehicle is at least as safe as a human driver, but we should be able to set the bar higher than that. But again, how do we measure that? And everyone in the industry is struggling with that. And so that's why you're seeing and I'm hearing companies just clamoring for facilities and areas to test. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, absence of a clear answer to that, they're putting thousands, millions of miles on their test vehicles. And I know Tesla is using that, and some other companies are using that as the metric of we've driven this many miles, right, without an accident. And there's a lot of holes in that metric. But to be fair, you know, whatever metric that we come up with, there'll be holes in that. That you could drive a truck through.
Well, I mean, let's, with the experts on the call here, let's talk about probably the biggest hole is that if we have a human behind the wheel that's intervening every time the algorithm makes a mistake, and then we say, okay, we're not going to count that 20 feet that the vehicle drove as part of the 2 million miles that we used to train it, what does those 2 million miles mean? If we take out all the difficult situations because humans are intervening, if we include that and it misbehaves slightly, but then we retune the algorithm slightly to adjust for that misbehavior, most of us would agree that the testing of the previous 2 million miles might not be representative, because that behavior that you just tweaked may have some unintended changes that were previously fixed that we just suddenly unfixed because we've tuned the algorithm slightly to be slightly better under this one situation. So, you know, the verifiability of the algorithm becomes a big challenge. This is the core IP of most companies. And so the algorithms themselves are closed off to external review. I joke with Paul before, I think last time you and I had dinner together, we were talking about, you know, the limited space available for academic work in this area, because the algorithms themselves are growing so quickly and in such a closed off manner that knowing what's under the hood from a software perspective, that's actually what makes or breaks these companies. And we're seeing lawsuits about that. We're seeing companies aggressively recruit engineers that have a good handle on what these algorithms do and mean. But the verifiability of the algorithms ultimately is the key test. And so the way that we're actually practically approaching it is we use these rules on the road, these data that we collect, to run simulations repeatedly. And then the corner cases, the problem cases in road, we tend to use those to redefine the simulations. So we can run, and I'm not exaggerating here, tens of thousands, if not millions of simulations of vehicle behavior under particular algorithm cases. But we want to make those simulation cases count. We want to put them through their paces and define the worst case scenarios. And I think that's where a lot of the interesting data gathering is taking place. It doesn't even have to be autonomous for us to gather that data. And so I envision probably about the next 5 or 10 years, these OEMs are going to be operating these vehicles. A lot of it will be a hands-off case, you know, basically collecting the information necessary, the maps, the routes, the human behavior, the corner cases that we need to think about that people may not have anticipated, and then coming up with elegant algorithms to test autonomy at increasing levels under these cases, and then using that to verify and certify the situations.
I agree. I think for me, if I were to describe the ideal situation, you know, I think all the companies are clamoring, as I mentioned, for, you know, how safe is safe. And I think if we had one, you know, an agreed upon standard, and we could, you know, set some metrics up against that, I think let me describe the situation. So, like, you know, insert your brand of vehicle, you know, Uber or whatever, you know, comes up to your door, you know, you some requested the vehicle on your app. Mm-hmm. You selected the driverless one, of course, because it's a third of as expensive as the other option, you know, the drivered option. The vehicle comes to the end of your driveway at your home. The door opens by itself. You look inside. There's nobody in there. Yeah. You know, what would make you feel comfortable getting in the vehicle? Or even a better question, what would make you feel comfortable putting your children in that vehicle to have it take them to soccer practice or something?
Probably free Wi-Fi.
Yeah, the Wi-Fi symbol on the side.
Yeah.
Because right at where we are, it's going to be the brand of the manufacturer. And like you're talking about, Sean, you know, they're going to be their core competency that they're going to aggressively protect. But I think, what if we had something like a 5-star system, you know, like we do for passive safety, for airbags, and, you know, where the vehicle pulls up and you can see this one has 3.5 stars, but this other app will send a 4.5. So, you know, people know 4.5 is better than 3.5, and why can't I have 5? And I think if we had you know, an SAE or an independent, you know, standards organization or NHTSA or, you know, some organization to come up and set a standard. And I agree, Sean, I think it would have to entail like tens of thousands, you know, a million of these corner cases, and that you can run, it would have to be some way that you could run your algorithm against all those corner cases very quickly and with clear metrics on pass fail conditions. I think that's what I think the industry would welcome with open arms, and I think we, the general public, would, of course, welcome with open arms.
Yeah. Well, it's not like we just need it's just like a system, like, you know, you can do 4 or 5 stars or whatever, like how, like, Uber and Lyft have 5-star systems for drivers and rating, you know, riders, right? So, you know, it just seems like you need some sort of arbitrary rating scale and just get people hooked on. And if it doesn't work, and he's like, "Oh well, that was terrible." Yeah, you walk from that. But you're talking about how people just show up to an empty vehicle and you just like it's some sort of like transformer, one that, you know, like robot or something like that. And but that kind of calls into question, like, what type of, you know, industries or, like, you know, niches that can come up of having autonomous vehicles. Like, one, we always assume, like, I'll just buy a car, it's autonomous, or I get an Uber. Is there something else that, like now we can, it doesn't matter where we're trying to drive to a place, we can just get into a car, work on our phones or whatever like that. Does that open up new industries?
Absolutely. I think we are just beginning to realize the potential there of the business models that can occur. I think in our minds, we're thinking of like the Uber, the driverless Uber type, right, and driverless taxi type model.
And we always seem to go to that one, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. But I think the fact that, as you're mentioning, the fact that that time in the vehicle is being given back to us. Mm-hmm. So I think that opens up a wealth of industry opportunities to that in terms of the user experience, the experience that the user experiences within that vehicle. So I think that opens up, you know, opportunities for like mobile McDonald's, you know, mobile fast food. You know, so like, not only do I want to get to my destination, but, you know, I'm hungry, yeah. And I could, you know, I'll have the time where I can, you know, grab a burger. Soccer. I like this idea. Soccer MOM, mobilizing our minors. So, you know, have a vehicle that pulls up. So, you know, you've got, you know, Sean, you know, your two little ones will have to go to soccer lessons and sometime soon, and you summon a vehicle and you put the two little ones in there, and the vehicle takes them to soccer lessons. Of course, I think that's a totally different business model. That's a totally different vehicle, because yeah, you want to be aware of what's going inside that vehicle every second that your precious kids are in it. You want to also hear what's going on there. You probably want to tell them, hey, settle down. Right. You're good, Johnny. And on, you know, mobile gyms, mobile saloons, and so on and so forth. So I think it just...
Mobile saloons is awesome. I mean, I was just going to ask about, you know, what kind of emotional relationships are we building with these vehicles? I know people who, you know, love their Corvette in ways that are hard to describe of love of humans, but and the soccer mom mobilizer miners was great, but saloons takes it to a whole other level.
Hey, mobile hotel rooms. When we start talking about, you know, these vehicles being able to drive us and us being productive inside them, we're starting to talk about business opportunities for people that would make short duration flights. The traveling businessman problem suddenly, or traveling salesman problem suddenly creates a whole new paradigm. If you get to sleep and live in your vehicle, you know, so we're starting to talk about markets would be privacy settings that I could adjust on the windows, adjustable tint on the windows so that people can't see into what I'm doing. We're talking about, you know, I joke that probably a big market's going to be toilet facilities that we can fit inside cars for long duration drives. We're starting to talk about vehicles that are going to be driving around empty. And so as much as we try to increase traffic throughput, if suddenly we have vehicles returning from airports or vehicles that are driving where we used to aggregate trips, I would pick up my kids at soccer practice, then go to the grocery store, then do something else. if we make the transportation cost that much less in terms of our time, then it's very reasonable to expect that, you know, right now only one of 30 to one of 50 vehicles are on the road at any one time. And if that goes to 2 out of 30 or 2 out of 50, we've just doubled the traffic on the road. So we could have huge congestion. And honestly, we all might not care. The big markets are going to be for high-speed data sharing, so that we can remain connected to our home offices on the vehicle, you know, connected to each other, virtual reality representations of the world and while we're in vehicle. These are going to be big things. I mean, vehicle seats that can turn into beds. We're talking about, how do I set up an office in a car such that it's airbag safe? You know, soft features all around the operator. There's going to be the vehicle of the future may look more like a mobile home than it does like, you know, the cars that we drive around in and put our children in. Other things are, you know, if that vehicle breaks down, how do we get it off the road quickly? The vehicles are going to be much more complex and much more sensitive to errors in the sensors or algorithms. And so if they pull over the side of the road in a safe manner, who's going to get them? Especially if, for example, it's Phoenix, Arizona, and grandma's in the vehicle. And, you know, she has a choice of stepping outside the vehicle and being in 120 degree weather or staying in the side of the vehicle and being in 120 degree weather and the vehicle shutting itself off. You know, life or death situations start to come up with tow trucks. So, you know, I think an autonomous tow truck rescue system is going to be a huge capability. You know, tractor trailer driving is going to be suddenly a very attractive field, I think, if you allow the ability for people to log in or sleep at the wheel so that they're not giving up a home life to be on the road. And these are just the obvious things. I joke with my realtor that the real estate market's going to change a lot when we don't have to pay this huge surcharge to live right next to where we work. And now we can hop in a vehicle and be productive along the way. In fact, we might want that, to live an hour away from our work and, you know, get twice the house for half the cost. I imagine vehicles becoming houses. And so our identity with that vehicle is suddenly going to become even more pronounced. If we talk about a sports car being an image, imagine if the vehicle is your living room / bedroom / entertainment, you know, area / office all at the same time.
I think this pie was big enough to have many slices, though. I think I agree with everything that we're saying, Sean. I think there'll be, you know, mobile living rooms, mobile bedrooms, mobile hotels, you know, but I also think that there will be people that, you know, they don't want to be attached to the vehicle, and they just, you know, want to have different apps for the different experiences that they want to have along the journey. But, and Simon, I also think that, you know, there's going to be people that want that V8 engine, and they're going to, you know, be proud of driving that V8 engine. They want to hear that engine, and they're going to run down all those boring autonomous vehicles on the road and do they have fun sense? Doing it.
I just missed the stick shift in my Saturn. I mean, nothing special. I liked it.
So I think it's, you know, we'll have many slices in this pie for a long time. It's just a matter of what we don't know is when those new pieces of the pie will be born and how fast they'll grow. That's really anyone's guess.
Yeah, it just seems like also, like, to Sean's, like, you talked about, like 1 out of 50 to 2, I guess 1 out of 25 cars are being on the road. Then what does that do to our road infrastructure, right? Is that, you know, we always hear, like, every, you know, election year, our infrastructure is terrible. We need to get it up to like par. And then also, are we going to invest in better roads? And having better roads helps the sensor. I don't know. You guys would speak to that. Like, better roads, better, like, fresh paint for lanes. It helps the car, self-driving car.
Or will we care? I mean, I last year I talked to a friend who's working at an intelligent shock company, shock absorbers, and they see an opportunity in automated vehicles where the automated vehicle will have a map, and it will know where the potholes are, where the speed bumps are, and so now can actively dampen those out, which that's engineering speak, meaning you won't feel the bumps, no matter, you know, even if for poor road conditions. Yeah. So, you know, will that be in every vehicle? No, but, you know, so, you know, that could be an argument for, we could live with worse roads longer.
Yeah. Well, you see, like, they, there's no way that cars would go through New Orleans because every road, every 5 feet, there's a pothole. So, you know,
and roads, you know, our meaning of roads might change a lot. You know, when we get into deep penetration levels of autonomous vehicles, we're starting to talk about things like negotiated intersections. You know, I look forward to the day when stop signs are a thing of the past because vehicles don't need to stop. They communicate with each other and slow down upon approach to an intersection and on the spot negotiate their way through that intersection without losing any type of fuel. I mean, it doesn't take a, you know, too much effort to sit down and go through the calculations of the fuel cost of an average stop sign. And it's on the order of $10,000 to $50,000 a year is what we pay for fuel lost by having a stop sign at most major roads. And that's something that if we can get that back, then suddenly we're not looking at all these signages out the road. We might end up be looking at virtual billboards everywhere and advertisements that are being sold to us on our inside windshields. But outside, our notion of a road might change. We might not actually need to pave the whole lane from right to left because we may, through the autonomous vehicles, have designated, you know, passing areas, and the vehicles could be precise enough to stay on this little concrete rail of road. And so we might only need the equivalent of like a concrete rail system for these vehicles. And so the opportunities that are out there are just immense, both for good and bad. And I think the theme of all of this discussion is really trying to learn how to balance that. And also to introduce the public to it, gain awareness of it, gain acceptance, and also some feedback, like what is just a non-starter in terms of public opinion.
Yeah, I agree with all that, Sean. But for me, the piece of it where the vehicles are talking to each other or they're talking to the intersection, that bit of it, that to me, that's decades away because that requires the vehicles to be talking to each other, you know, through the DSRC radios, like you were talking about earlier, or the 5G communication. And for that, we would need, you know, almost near 100% penetration of that technology, right?
I agree. I think we're probably two or three decades away from this. But it's the kind of thing where I talk to my kids, like, take a lot of pictures of intersections and billboards. People are going to look back at that, and that's really going to name the era that we live in today. And our notion of what lane markers are might disappear. We might just have these QR codes that are painted on these random signs next to us that designate to the vehicle exactly where it is, where its position is relative to the world, far better than a lane marker might.
John, I want to plug something that you've been working on, you know, and touch what you were talking about earlier. You know, you were saying that, you know, for when the vehicle breaks down, you know, with the vehicles will have a number of redundant systems on board, and so it'll know when one of those systems has failed, it'll still have enough capability that it can, you know, pull off to the side and request for help. You know, one of those systems is certainly the global positioning system that enables the vehicle to know where it is. And there really isn't a backup for that system. And that can fail in so many ways, like, you know, in urban canyons and downtown cities where, you know, the GPS signals can get bounced around and lost. You know, the vehicle, you know, can struggle to actually know where it is within, you know, several feet or several meters. And there's only one system that I've ever heard of, Sean, that could possibly be a backup for that system. That's this technology that you've been working on. Maybe if you can describe that for folks, to me that's fascinating. I think there's lots of opportunity there.
Yeah. So, you know, recognizing that GPS is an Achilles heel for many of these systems, we've been working for about 10 or 15 years now, Paul, and you've been a good part of that discussion about developing landmarks in sensors that are already on the vehicle. We've done everything from inertial sensing, you know, the accelerometers that are in our vehicle or the gyros that are in our vehicle to measure our spin and balance of the vehicle. Those create fingerprints that allow us to verify where we are on the road. And using wheel odometry, we can then predict forward. We've been moving forward with that to visual landmarks. That capability is something that is quite robust now, particularly, Sebastian Thrun, one of the early architects for the fleet that eventually became the Google's team. They're well known for developing visual ways of representing the world and landmarks and creating maps. And so it's no surprise that the key players in this field are going to be data providers and data management systems, because that verification really is going to take place the same way we as drivers verify. We glance at the road. We've probably driven most roads that we've been on hundreds, if not thousands of times. And we can glance at the road and verify our situation and then look away and have a conversation. And the reason we can do that is because we keep within ourselves, you know, these roadmaps of key features, key decision points, and we're allowed to disengage. And that level of data compression is something that we're learning how to do. We, as you know, all engineers in the field are learning how to do, but it is something that I've been working on for about a decade now.
Well, I think this is a good spot to wrap up. So it's been a great hour. Look, I'm more excited and scared than I was an hour ago.
So. Yeah, I'm still trying to decide what it'll look like at the car dealership.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the scared part, you know, I would echo back the comments that were made earlier about the potential for lives saved in these systems. It's quite profound. And that for me, and I know for Paul as well, and almost all of our colleagues, you know, this has gotten to be a really, quote, sexy field lately, and a lot of attention's given to autonomy. But what's driving a lot of this is the awareness that the human decision-making is becoming the weak link. And as we get more distracted and more connected and more information overloaded on the road, the idea of leaning on autonomy to help shows great promise. I think the thing that we need to think about, though, is what are we giving up? Eventually, we're all going to not know how to drive well, at least not compared to the algorithms that are available to us. And as society, we're going to go through a change. And I think thinking through that on the level of, you know, trying to anticipate what will happen would be, you know, we're now putting together the assembly line for the Model T, you know, back in the 1900s. And we're trying to think about, okay, well, what's urban sprawl? What's smog? What's a traffic jam? And these are all things that didn't exist, you know, in the late 1800s. And so with the promise of mobility and assistance to society, we have to try to think of the secondary and tertiary impacts as well. It's exciting. And so I think I'm glad to see so much attention and have this opportunity to talk about it, because I think it's in our lifetime going to be one of the most profound changes that we get to experience.
Yeah, I agree. I think this has been a fascinating progression. I mean, we had the information age, which quickly followed by the information overload age, which was quickly followed by the age of distracted driving, which we're in now. And now we're, you know, approaching the age of automated vehicles. So it's an interesting set of directions that we followed. But I think it's absolutely exciting. It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, we're on the cusp of a lot of things happening. I mean, when Sean and I were last having dinner, I think, you know, the news, big news articles in this field would happen like, you know, once a month, once every other month. And now, I mean, it's like every week there's significant news and breakthroughs, and from all the way from, you know, down at the sensor level capabilities, the capability and the cost of the sensors, is the capabilities going up, the costs are coming down. It's just fascinating, impressive. Up to the subsystem level, up to the vehicle technology level, the AI, all the way up to policy, and so there's just so much happening. It's impossible now for me to keep up with. Sean, you're in it full time. I know. I'm sure you're struggling with it as well. But just overloaded, but. But amazing, and it's fun. So I expect some, and I think here in the next upcoming year, I think you know, if we have this podcast again, you know, one year, it'll be really interesting to look back, and I think we'll see a number of milestones being hit.
Well, I'm game for being back here in a year. You guys are.
So. Let's have turkey together though next time. How's okay. That?
Sounds good. Let's all get our autonomous vehicles and get together.
There you go.
Okay. One's with toilets and Wi-Fi.
I'll get on the McDonald's one.
Okay. Cool. Sean, is there anywhere people online can get reach out to you or I'll follow up with you?
Yeah, I'm available. My address is sbrennan@psu.edu, sbrennan@psu.edu.
And Paul?
Sure, yeah. if you go to our website at Mass Robotics, M-A-S-S Robotics, all one word, .org, massrobotics.org, you can find my contact information, but it's Paul S, P-A-U-L-S, at massrobotics.org. Happy to converse with folks.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, gentlemen, for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Great seeing you, Sean.
Yeah, you too, Paul. We'll have to do dinner again here soon.
I look forward to it.